Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium. Opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Greetings. This is Onaji Mweed, co-host of Race Treaty, and we'd like to invite you to stay tuned, stay here, be with us tonight as we continue to explore self-determination, self-respect, self-reliance. And tonight we have two guests. Two guests will be with us, and I'm very happy to say that we're doing something special tonight in that it's intentionally an intergenerational discussion. I have had the pleasure of meeting these two individuals in two different arenas, but for the same cause, for the same purpose. That is the upliftment of people of African descent, and they have dedicated their lives to that inquiry and to that mission. So I'm not going to spend too much time in terms of introduction, other than the fact that we are here to have a robust conversation on the question of human rights for people of African descent in this, what is called the International Decade for People of African Descent from 2015 to 2024. And because I don't want to leave anything out, I'm going to ask our guests to introduce themselves, and certainly through the interview, certain things will come forward about these individuals, because if they told you all that they did, actually that would take up the whole program in and of itself. And I don't mind that, actually, but in terms of these are modest, humble individuals who I'm sure they're not going to tell us everything, but enough to kind of get it started. So welcome to Race Treaty, that comes to you every Friday night between 9 and 10. And sometimes we have extended broadcasts, as we will tonight, for probably an hour and a half. So you can call your friends, tell them to listen to the radio station, the web, Black Talk Radio Network, so they can join in and be, of course, surprised. Do remember that we do archive our shows, so you would have the opportunity to also come back to it, you know, again and again, and refer people to the show again and again. So that's indeed an invitation, not only for this show, but all for the previous recorded and to be recorded shows, that this creates an archive for you, for your family, for your organizations, for our people to reference and to use. And if I see my board correctly, it appears that Queen Mother Randall has joined us. Is that not so?
Yes, I'm here. This is Professor Randall.
Oh, Professor Randall. It is such an honor and a delight to be on this webcast with you. For so many reasons. I will bring to the attention of our listening audience that we met actually in Durban, South Africa.
Yep.
We were delegates to the United Nations World Conference Against Racism, and most people don't know this. In fact, that was the third. It wasn't the first. It was actually the third conference on race. Indeed, the most successful one, and the one that has been buried from world attention for so many reasons. It was there in Durban that we met, and we spoke, you know, here and there, as you do, going in and out of sessions. And after we got back to the United States, we would cross each other at different times, speaking on the same question of human rights, speaking on the question, the demand for reparations, and just understanding what happens to people who are colonized, who are living in domestic colonization, and the world doesn't understand that. But we have, in fact, internalized all of that, because to put us in this subordinate position required centuries upon centuries of terrorism, of torture, of pain and humiliation, and systems upon systems to keep us in those positions. And we're going to talk about that. Queen Mother Randall, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for agreeing to be with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Really a joy to be here.
So can you share with our listening audience, you know, your background? You know, I know that you are an emeritus professor. You've taught law for how many years? Did you practice law? Tell us about you. We want to know about you.
Well, I grew up in Texas in the 50s in segregated high schools and segregated elementary schools, and went to University of Texas in nursing. And I was a practicing nurse and family nurse practitioner, actually, for 15 years, which is how I got an interest in health care and the law, which is my primary area. I practiced out on the Pacific Northwest and in Alaska. Went to law school in my mid to late 30s. Practiced law for about 3 years, and then I have taught in law. I taught in law school full time for 26 years, and I've been retired for the last 5 years, teaching part time. My primary focus was race and racism in American law and healthcare law. And starting in 2000, right before I met you, I got involved in international human rights, because when they were planning the World Conference Against Racism, no one was really dealing with the health component from the NGO perspective as an organized thing. And so I kind of stepped into that space and worked to have the healthcare issues strongly represented at the World Conference Against Racism. Health issues, not just healthcare, but health issues. Yeah. And so I've been involved in one way or another with the human rights movement since that time.
Wow. Okay. So what I'd like to do is take those different transition points as topical paragraph sentences and go back and look at these different paragraphs of your life. So you were raised in Texas, and you said in the segregated South.
Right. I actually went to a two-room school. And the interesting thing, which I like to get out here, is my grandfather, who was born right at the end of slavery, like 1865 or 66, helped started a school for black kids in Texas so that he could get his kids educated. He couldn't read or write. And so he was one of the founders of what is now Jarvis Christian College in Texas. But my dad graduated from Jarvis, and we went to, you know, segregated schools, two-room schools, three-room schools, and I graduated from a segregated high school.
So for those of us who, I would not include others who did not experience the love and the insular aspect that we enjoyed doing what was called segregation, which, I mean, another way of looking at it, it was really just community-centered. Tell us about how was it growing up as a young Black child with Black people, seeing them doing these things. Give us a little a feel for that, that life you lived as a child.
I have to tell you that for me, I was not, that we, I grew up, it felt protected.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, you had to deal occasionally, and quite frankly, that not that often from my perspective. I had, as a child, I'm not talking about as adult, because for the adults, it was an entirely different thing. But as a child, you know, my community was the people around me who were Black, the kids who were around me who were Black, my teachers who were Black, the doctor who was Black, the and I, we sure, when we went places, you know, there were the white only signs and we saw all that. But one of the things I've thought about often is that my kids had to deal with racism and in a way that I never did as a child. I mean, there's a whole different, to me, there's a different category of racism when you're 5, 6 years old, 9, 10 years old, and your day-to-day life, day in, day out, you're not dealing with racism. At least I wasn't.
Mm.
It was happening because we were in segregated schools. It was happening because we couldn't go to the movies. It was happening because we couldn't shop for clothing. But as a child, I really didn't deal with that. Just like your like children today. But it seems to me that what integration brought and is that our children now have to deal with the racism on a daily basis because they're in racist institutions.
Mm-hmm. So this this protective cocoon that you were in, with this love, with this respect, and seeing different, if you will, professional aspirations and see people achieving. So is it fair to say that as a young Black girl growing up, you had this great expectation of your life and what you would do in life because you saw people around you doing those things? Is that a fair?
I never questioned it, although I have to admit that, you know, the reality is I don't want to paint it with rose-colored glasses because I always, I'm always kind of fearful of dropping into the way we were syndrome. You know, we tend to look at things in the past as so much better than what we currently have, and I don't really want to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt the community had major problems and was in many ways dysfunctional, so in some ways dysfunctional. But as to the aspect of dealing with racism, yes, Black children had to deal with it. And in some places, they had to deal with it overtly in their face because of the proximity. But for many communities, for many Black people, there were not the proximity. For now, I guess I both, I was different when I look at my graduating class and I look at the Black kids that I went to college with and how well everybody's done, we all came from that. And so it's interesting to me about how successful, I'd have to say, that as a group of Black people who went through college in the 1960s, late 1960s, early 70s, that as a group we've done really well. And I wonder to what extent was having that firm self-esteem. Now, there's plenty of Black people who didn't succeed, plenty of Black people who didn't have the success they deserved because of the poverty, because of racism, because of all kinds of things. But I do think what is missing in our children's life is the sense of security from seeing blackness all the time in successful modes and not having a question. It's not an example of what you can do, you know, like bringing in a, you know, bring your parent to school day. Everybody in the school was just like your parents.
Okay. So as a child, you have this, you know, panoramic view of the world and all these possibilities, seeing these role models in front of you. As a child, did you think about being a nurse then growing up, or did you have a number of things that you thought about as a child, which you wanted to become? How did nursing win out?
Well, the thing first of the matter is the older I got, the more I got subject to racism and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And though I graduated second in my high school, I graduated from an educated black family, and so going to college would have been second generation going to college. There was still this sort of limitation on what black people could do, an expectation, because remember, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 had been passed, it really hadn't opened up a whole lot of things. And so people, even though I graduated, in the 60s, people were still saying, well, you know, if you want to get a job, you need to be a teacher or a nurse. And that was the two choices that were put in front of me. It never really occurred to me to do anything else. I guess I did think about going into medicine once, but so yeah, I think the choices were still really limited in terms of what people were told they could do. And I think that people who made different choices, I really admire them because they had to strike out on their own from the system.
So before you decided to go into nursing, what did you have on as a target?
I did not really. I wasn't this person who said I want to do this, I want to do that. I knew from my parent, my foster mother and my father, there was an expectation that I would go to college, but I had no clue about what I was going to do. And I sort of stumbled in nursing because people advised me.
Okay, you just mentioned something that's a discovery. You said foster parents?
Yeah, my mother died when I was and I had a very unusual childhood, and my mother died when I was 9 years old, and there's a whole story about behind her death in a Philadelphia hospital on the black ward for patients. She died of cancer, and in a Pennsylvania hospital and they had black ward for women. My mom made my dad promise not to separate us. And so what that meant was nobody really wanted three kids. And so we moved around quite a bit from relatives to relatives, but three was hard. And towards my high school years, we ended up living with a lady who was a friend of my dad's, and I called her my foster mother. It wasn't a formal foster situation like you think of now through the state, but it was one of those, which was... My impression wasn't that uncommon in the black community, informal foster situation where someone in the community took someone in. Now, my foster mother, and this is a whole nother story, I used to bootleg because she used to bootleg. And we ran all kind of joints juice joints and all kinds of joints, and we had people on the Chitlin circuit who would come to our different bars and stuff like that. Now, she was college educated, too. But being college, you know, one of the things that I say to people is, don't tell me how black people don't appreciate education, because black people get an education, have been getting an education ever since white people stopped, ever since white people got out of our way. We have been getting education even when there really wasn't going to be any jobs. People were going back in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 20s. People were getting education and going to college when they knew they weren't going to get no job from it. That a few of them would end up teachers, but most of them would be just, you know, doing whatever they do to earn a living. But they weren't going to get any jobs. There weren't massive jobs for educated black people. And even now, I say our college education, we still go to college, even though we know of the discrimination against black people, and we know we're going to be underpaid. So why do we do it? Because we appreciate education.
Wow. Okay.
So anyway, my foster mother, yes. So that's a part of my life. I grew up helping to run juice joints. I grew up helping to run, we called it a hotel, but in fact it was more like someplace people rented rooms by the hour. And I grew up, but I also, my family, my foster mother, my father, and all my family had a high appreciation for education. So there was always an expectation that I would go to college.
So certainly my condolences in terms of losing your mother at such an early, tender age. I would have to say that had an impact on you.
It has had a profound impact on me and my interest in healthcare and interest. But one of the things is, you know, seeing my mother die in a black ward and having to go up into the black entrance at 9 when we was in Pennsylvania before we moved back to Texas, and hearing my dad talk about the kind of healthcare that they couldn't get. That has had a profound, that I think has what raised my interest in health and healthcare.
I was about to ask you that question, and it surfaced because I could see how that would be a corollary. For me, becoming a substance abuse counselor had everything to do with my father being an alcoholic.
Yes.
And how that kind of pushed me through the back door into the field of counseling, and particularly alcohol and drug counseling. So I can see how those earlier situations would, in fact, encourage someone to do that. So in high school, take us back. You graduated high school. What's on your mind at that time?
Well, I was still in a foster home. I was still working for my foster mother. And going to college. I went to a junior college. And my mind at that time, I was not heavily involved in civil rights. I was not that's a misstatement right there. I was not involved in civil rights.
So you say I'm not even qualified. I'm going to say absolutely I was.
No, I mean, you know, and it's one of the things I think we have in order to do service to the people who are the young people who are on the line now. Those of us need to stop pretending that the whole community was out there. The whole community wasn't. A fraction of the community was. And I was in the fraction that wasn't. I was in the major portion of the community that wasn't. Primarily because life circumstances was all I could deal with. And so to me, to be quite honest, civil rights was the least important thing in my life 1964.
So 65, that's the year you graduated from high school?
Yes.
So,
66.
So, okay, so going to, okay, graduation. You had already chosen your college?
My foster mother chose, I actually did really well on testing and got a number of offers around the United States, Vanderbilt, number of different offers. But my foster mother said to me, you're not ready to go home. You're going to the junior college. So that's where I went.
Mm-hmm. So now, where was your father at the time this was happening?
My father, who was a teacher, was living out on the West Coast. Working for Job Corps.
Oh, so he wasn't there with you physically?
No.
Okay, so 9 years old, your mother passed, and you had said earlier your mother had made your father make a promise to not to break you up, meaning you and your sibling?
Yes, siblings? I had two other siblings. I had a brother and a sister. And for the longest time, I was very angry at my father, very angry. As you can imagine, children get angry over stuff. And certainly him shopping us around to different families, and whenever they get tired, he would look for another place to move us, that caused quite a bit of anger on me. But as I got older, I realized that he did the best he could under the circumstances. And one of the circumstances was he promised not to break us up.
Mm.
And he didn't. I tell you, we never spent not even a week apart.
So where are you in terms of the sibling order? Are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
So my foster mother had quite a bit of control over me and my life until I graduated from Amarillo Junior College and went away to the University of Texas, where I went to the School of Nursing.
And
it took me 6 years to finish college, because once I got to the University of Texas, I got involved in civil rights. I got involved in the war movement. I got involved in partying, I got involved in everything but studying.
So you was living life, huh?
Yes, I feel good.
So that, well, you know, I can relate. My undergraduate pursuit did not terminate with a degree because I was living in Brooklyn, New York, attending Pratt Institute for Engineering, but spending most of my time either at the East, Yehuda's school, Yehuda Sasser, or traveling around the country working in cooperative appointments with General Electric or General Motors. So from 73 to 80, I was involved with this cooperative education program and also an African-centered learning in terms of the East. So when I left, I didn't have it either. But I went back to school and acquired my master's. We'll talk about that later. So now you're in junior college and things are happening around you. SNCC is happening. King is happening. And it got your attention because you made the point.
No, I'm in college. I'm in the University of Texas. When I was in junior college, I was still living in Amarillo with my foster mother, and nothing got my attention beside her.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you go to Texas, you went to the University of Texas.
At Austin.
Okay, that's where my son is living. So what happened there? What was the thing that said, wait a minute, there's a whole other part of life that I'm not privy to or involved in?
Yeah, you know, I guess one of the things is I've always had sort of this standing up for the younger, because I was kind of protective of my brothers and sisters. And so I was always able to talk and articulate and push for stuff. And someone was saying to me, And I was kind of surprised. We all admired you at Texas because you always seem to know how to get stuff or know what to do. And so I just got involved. I thought the war was wrong, and so I got in the war movement. I thought I got involved in black student affairs on campus. I got appointed to the athletic council because the guy they was making this big deal about appointing this gay guy who got elected to president at Texas A&M. Well, when I was at the University of Texas, this white guy who was a hippie got elected, and he decided to do the much he could to undermine institutions, and so he decided to appoint a black woman to the athletic council, which governed all of athletics at the University of Texas, and I got appointed to that. And so I got away from home, and I start looking around and learning and got active. And so that was the start of my involvement.
Out of those things, what was the first one that got you activated and involved? What was the first one? The first meeting that you went to?
Oh, God, I don't remember. That's over 60 years ago. 50 years ago.
Well, okay, not the first meeting, just the first issue that got you involved.
I can't say what the first issue was. I really can't. I just know that we worked to get a black student union, and I was heavily involved and responsible for that. We worked to get integration in the student housing. They were still housing black women in a separate house, and so we were some of the first to integrate the dormitories. I don't really remember what the first thing was, and to tell you the truth, I don't remember it. I don't remember anything major significant.
Okay,
it was just life. Just
got you.
So whatever was going on at the campus at the time, I was involved in it.
Okay. So you mentioned that it took you 6 years, and is that to infer that under normal circumstances a student would go through in 4 years?
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
And the only reason, I have to tell, to be honest, the only reason I graduated is I got pregnant in my fourth year, sophomore year. So I was a four-year sophomore, and I became pregnant and decided to keep the child. That's my oldest son.
Wow.
And that was people often say, I am convinced that my life would have been different had I not gotten pregnant and had I not decided to keep him. Because
different now.
Because I was still running wild.
Oh, okay, I got it. You were still running wild.
I was still running wild. I had no self-esteem. I had no sense of doing anything for myself. I had no sense of this thinking about what the next thing was going to be. I was just doing.
Wow.
And when I got pregnant with my oldest son, Shock is his name, it dawned on me that I was going to flunk out. And then I'd be a pregnant woman. First of all, it dawned on me that I couldn't go home because Christine, which is a whole other story, was abusive. And so there was no way I was going to go back to Christine, which is what a lot of people did at that age when they got pregnant. They went home. Well, I wasn't going home. I wasn't getting married, and I wasn't having an abortion. So the only thing left for me to do is to continue school. So I did.
So,
when most pregnant women my age left school, I stayed on campus, pregnant and single. And being pregnant focused me. It really did. It was like if you don't graduate with this nursing degree, you're going to be a black woman without an education. And how are you going to take care of this baby? And my academics changed. It didn't change being involved in stuff. It just changed the seriousness of my studies.
Okay, so let's put this in perspective. You're pregnant in your sophomore year. And were you able to finish your school year?
I finished my school year, had my baby in May, went to summer school, came back the next year as a junior.
You finished school and had your baby in May when the semester was over?
Yes.
So where were you living with the baby? They don't usually have babies.
They don't let you be in there. I had to move out the dorm because I was pregnant. They don't let pregnant girls stay in the dorm. We corrupt people.
You're a bad influence.
We're a bad influence. Back then, no. You don't stay in the dorm. You move out.
So how did you?
I had an apartment, and then when I couldn't afford the apartment anymore, my brother and his went off to war, and I moved in with my sister-in-law and took a room in their house.
And this is in Texas?
Yeah. Yes.
In Austin?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So you went back to, returned to school after having your baby in May, returned to school in September with this renewed, directed, focused, attitude about your life.
Yes.
Really focused.
Yes.
And so I guess I would say that you experienced school quite differently these last 2 years than the previous four.
Sort of. I mean, I didn't party. I had a baby. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't involved in things that had meetings as much, but I still say I was fairly active in terms of social justice, civil rights, black issues type of thing. But no, yes, I did experience school very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated. And
what year was that when you graduated?
I graduated in 72.
72. Wow. Okay, so you graduated with a nursing degree.
Correct.
And then you practiced nursing in Texas?
No, I moved to Portland, Oregon, and I helped integrate a hospital emergency room and had my first experience at the hospital emergency room of how white institution changes rules when they don't want black people to be in positions of authority.
Okay, wait a minute. Here you are, grew up in Texas, and now you. How did you get to Oregon?
My dad lived in Oregon, and I decided to move out there where he was.
Uh huh. Okay.
And so I got a job at a hospital, Best Kaiser Hospital. And I graduated with a 4-year degree from nursing. And this was at a time when, you could get nursing degrees. You get a bachelor's degree. You get a hospital degree. And the hospital had a rule that during the weekend, when the regular supervisor staff was off, the person with the most education would be supervising, all other things being equal in terms of length of employment. The person with the most education would be the supervising nurse. I was that person.
I know what's coming next.
Suddenly they changed the rule to actual experience on the hospital floor, which meant that the young lady who went to a 3-year school, we graduated the same time, so we actually had the same amount of postgraduate experience. But she went to a hospital school, and so they decided she was more experienced, and she became the supervisor nurse. And that's what drove me to Washington to get University of Washington to get my master's degree as a family nurse practitioner.
Okay.
So, and then from there, I went to Alaska, where I worked 6.5 years, 7 years in Alaska before I went to law school.
Did you know Dorothy, what's Dorothy's last name, Lewis?
No, I didn't.
Okay, I got you. A reparation activist, but also lived in Alaska. And you're probably contemporaries. She's passed, you know, she was the phenomenal human rights activist on the question of reparations. So I want to go back one moment. When did you tell your father you was pregnant, and what did he say?
I think I told him when I was in school, you know, and he asked, what could he do?
Wow.
And he said that he thought it was a good decision for me to stay in school.
Wow.
My father, one of the big things that people, and this is, I actually would like to see a study done in this, because people always talk, in my family, my grandfather's family, he educated his children in the order of birth. And that meant that many of the girls got educated before the boys. But I can remember growing up hearing my father say to me and my uncle say to my cousins, girl, you better get you an education, because you never know where that man's going to be and you may have to support that child. And the more I think about it, we don't give credit for that attitude, because white people are always talking about how the boys get educated first. But I was thinking, yeah, if you were a family in the South with limited job opportunities, there's all kinds of different work that men can do that don't put them in a position of being taken advantage of. But women, there's limited things that a woman can do that don't end up being her working in somebody's house where she can be taken advantage of. So it seemed to me that one of the things that it has maybe hidden is that one of the reasons that there used to be such an emphasis on getting girls educated is so that they wouldn't have to go into those white masters' houses and be raped.
Wow. Man. Wow, isn't that something?
So my dad, you know, he was very, things happen, and if staying in school is the best thing you could do.
And what happened to, in terms of your brothers and your sister? You said the brother and the sister?
Yeah, my brother worked, he's died, and my brother worked in Texas, went to college for a few years, dropped out, but then worked for an oil company until he died. He died a few years ago. My sister was, being the youngest, you know, youngest always feel like they have more freedom. So she wanted to be an actor and actress, and she did a lot of work around that. But she ultimately got a degree in computer science and computer programming, and worked for the state of Alaska until she retired.
Wow, so she stayed in Alaska.
Yes. When I moved to go to law, I left Alaska to go to law school. And when I left to go to law school, she decided to stay there. So I went to law school in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did you wind up leaving the nursing field?
Well, I was in Alaska working as the maternal child for the state of Alaska. And a couple of things came around. There's the story I used to tell people, you know, the professional story. Professional story is I'm always interested in health disparities and improving health disparities, and I knew the law would help me. The real story was that I was working. I had another child by this time, my second son, and I was living up there, and I was working, and I wanted to be in the commissioner's office. I had a master's degree in nursing, maternal child nursing, and they kept promoting white men right out of graduate schools into my office. I would train them, and then they'd get promoted into the commissioner's office. And I looked around and I thought, I have three stereotypes on me, three big stereotypes. I'm a of not being very intelligent. I'm a woman, I'm black, and I'm a nurse. Those are the stereotype about all three of those categories are not very intelligent. And I thought, I can quit being a nurse. And frankly, the only reason I went to law school is because people think lawyers are smart. That's their stereotype. They say it all the time. It's not true, but people do think lawyers are smart. So I went to law school primarily because I wanted people to say, oh, you must be smart.
Wow. So those of you who may be just turning in to Race Treaty, I'm one of the co-hosts, Onaji Muid, and I'm talking to Queen Mother Vanella Randall, who is sharing with us her life, her childhood, going to a two-year college, then going to University of Texas, how she's made these transitions in various disciplines. She's emeritus professor of law, School of Law, since 1990, who writes extensively on and speaks internationally about race, women, and healthcare. She's the recipient of the Ohio Commission on Minority Health Chairman's Award and was named one of the top 10 most influential African Americans on the 2001 Black Equal Opportunity Employment Journal list. Professor Randall has always been associated with the study, hasn't really always been associated with the study and practice of law, because she's sharing with us her background in terms of nursing. She says, I grew up during the Jim Crow era in the South. For a black woman going to college, you either became a nurse or a teacher. She chose nursing. She did like the profession, though, and had worked in nursing homes while in high school. And as a nurse, Professor Randall provided public health nursing services and served as an administrator for the statewide health program in Alaska. And now we are in the part of her life where she is graduated with a nursing degree, got a master's degree in nursing, was another way being discriminated against, and said, I'm not being held back by, you know, these different stereotypes. I'm going to go to law school. So tell me, how did it feel when you were applying to law school? Did you feel you were going to get in? Did you feel there was going to be a 50-50 chance? What were your feelings just about applying to law school?
Well, it never occurred to me not to. You know, I guess people make a big deal, but one of the things my son's oldest son says about me, he's a lawyer now in Florida, is that what he learned from my life is always make choices that give you more choices. And so it never occurred to me that there was going to be any problem. So I felt confident that I would get into law school, and I did. I didn't have the best undergraduate GPA. In fact, I had a 2.3, and that was after 2 years of really excelling work my junior and senior year. I had I don't do well on standardized tests, so I couldn't even point to that. But I did get into several law schools, and I ended up choosing Lewis and Clark because it was in Portland and my dad was in Portland.
Okay.
I was the only black, this was in 1987, I was the only Black in my class and one of two Blacks in the whole law school.
How did that feel?
It was both. It was interesting because, well, first of all, I've been an only ever since I went to the University of Texas. No, ever since Amarillo Junior College. So being the only Black in a class was part of what I learned to deal with. It was stressful, and I don't think that people understand the stress of to Black people of working in historically white institutions. And I am convinced that chronic racial stress is the reason for the disparity in health between Blacks and whites of the same income. And it was very stressful. There was a point, I remember this episode so well, where I just got tired of looking at white people. I just felt like I can't take another second of this. And I needed to cry. And I realized I had no place to go where I could have any privacy. And I ended up in the bathroom. And I'm not even sure why. It wasn't that anybody did anything bad to me or say anything bad to me or that there was any kind of overt racism or any kind of anything. It was just that the microaggressions and dealing with the constant sort of, stupid questions that you know come out of stupidity. And it was just the stress of having to listen to law professors do this analysis as if history made no difference in terms and race made no difference, that, you know, it's all one race and we don't need to know the race of the plaintiff because the courts don't take that into consideration. So you're sitting there, you're thinking, this is crazy. Luckily, I think being an older student, I was able to, hold on my value system. I was pretty active on campus. I really still was pretty active on things. I got involved in trying to get more Black people admitted to Lewis and Clark. I got involved in help because one of the things that law school is hard because they don't tell you what you need to do in order to succeed. Mm-hmm. And they do that so that they can make people think that it's a difficult profession. See, but I, having been a bad student who almost flunked out, I came to law school not with the idea that I was there to prove anything to anybody else. I was there just to get my degree. And so I studied the system. And one of the things I learned about school is that you really need to know the system and just give them what they want. And so people was always complaining about how poorly Blacks do in law school and how they don't pass the bar the first time. But part of the problem is they hide the ball. And they don't tell people what it is they need to do. It's kind of like, and in fact, I've used this as an example. If someone told you they were going to teach you how to play piano but never gave you a piano, and all they taught you was sheet music, but at the end of the course they rolled the piano in, who's going to do well? Not never been on a piano, but the people who have been exposed to the pianos before. So I really was active in trying to get them to change how they approach at least their academic support program. But that was all very stressful. So, yeah, it was pretty stressful.
So this you talked about a moment when you was just totally bewildered and you went to the bathroom. This is when you were a student in law school?
Yes. I was in my 30s, mid-30s, late-30s.
Mm-hmm. And you were in class or you were just –
I was just walking around, and I just got this overwhelming need not to see white people, not to just get them out of my vision. I didn't want to see them. I don't know. Maybe something had happened in class. I don't think so. I just think the thing was, it was just more of the same ridiculousness. And I didn't, and I didn't want to have to try to explain to how anyone. I didn't want people looking at me and asking me what's wrong, because I didn't I couldn't say to them what was wrong without getting into a huge row over whether I should feel that way or not. And I'm sure if you work in a historically white institution, you felt that way. You felt like, I just don't feel like this, but if I say something, then I'm going to be in a huge, it's going to all blow up. And so I just need to go someplace and calm down.
Okay, so is there a word for that? Now, what comes to mind on the other side of the fence, right, is xenophobia. When people are afraid of other people and they, you know, they remove themselves and do everything to not be involved with other people. The fear of other people is xenophobia. So this is not a fear of other people that's stemming from your own internal psychological state. This is a feeling that has come about because of how you were treated all these years and what you were experiencing.
Exactly.
Is there a word for that? I don't know.
I know of, but it would be nice to have a word. Because I really think that racialized stress, until we deal with that, our health, right now, we die 10 years, middle-class black people die 10 years younger than middle-class white people.
10 years.
Poor black people die 3 years younger than poor white people. I think that's all racial stress. And the reason why I think middle-class people have a bigger gap is because I think working in historical white institutions provide a kind of stress that's amazing.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we have to come up with the word, and we have to come up with a field of study and practice. In medicine, there's a word for when you're creating your whole medical system, ideology.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that the chronic stress, chronic racialized stress thing is pretty well recognized in infant and prenatal. The reason why is that there's this huge death rate of the death rate and of black infants and the low birth weight rate, the low birth weight rate percentage for black people is larger than many African countries.
Oh,
and so they've been studying this for a long time, and they finally have had to admit that there really isn't a difference in behavior. There's a when you compare class to class, that is, so you don't compare poor black people. I mean, you don't compare poor black people to middle class black people. You compare poor black people to poor whites and middle class black people to middle class white. When you do that comparison, there is not a significant difference in behavior. Eat the same kind of foods, exercise about the same, work in similar high-risk jobs, live in the same kinds of relative neighborhoods. So the only real explanation is chronic racial stress, in my mind. And, yeah, we do need a whole field of study.
So we're talking to Queen Mother Rando, who, in fact, is the author of Dying While Black.
Yeah, that's right. 2006, I wrote that. I'm actually working on, it's not exactly an update because I'm going to name it something different, but I'm working on something to focus on Daya's health. And so I'll be using new statistics.
We certainly look forward to that, to add to the long list of publications, Built in Obsolescence, the Coming End to the Abortion Debate, Eliminating racial discrimination in healthcare, a call for state healthcare anti-discrimination law, the misuse of the LSAT, discrimination against blacks and other minorities in law school admissions, African Americans, nursing home care, and the law, chapter in vulnerable populations and long-term care continuum, and the list goes on. The continuum of her writings go on and on and on. So, how did you mix your previous health career in terms of nursing and law? How did those two things come together?
Well, I decided to teach. And I decided to teach right out of law school. I actually started teaching. The law school I graduated from didn't have a healthcare law course, and so I started teaching there as an adjunct. And when I decided to move into full-time teaching, it seemed natural to me to say healthcare. You know, I'm a public health nurse. I have a master's degree in public health. I did my master's in nursing, and so it seemed that teaching law, that healthcare would be a perfect fit. Then my scholarship has always been around healthcare law and race because of my interest of what's happening to Black Americans in this country is always. As a nurse, I've always been interested in it, and then that just seemed to be a natural fit. So when I hunted for teaching, when you hunt for a teaching job, you got to say what you're interested in teaching. And so I said I was interested in teaching healthcare law.
So did you convince the school to create that course?
Which one?
The one in terms of health law and health.
Yes. The Lewis and Clark Law School didn't have a health law course when I graduated, and I convinced them as a new graduate to have a course, and I taught it there.
So how did you go about doing that?
See, my feeling is the worst thing that people can say to you is no. In my mind, no means not now. I truly believe no means not now. And in fact, I frustrated. There's a whole nother life in terms of all of the problems I had at the law school. And one of the deans got up in my face and said, "We are tired of dealing with you. We are tired of your games." And I said to him, "It's not my game. It's your game. I just play it better." And
this is the dean,
associate dean. And the thing is what they were frustrated with is I truly believe in no need not now. And so often when people say no, people get frustrated, get mad, and go off and leave it alone. When you say no to me, if I think I'm right, I just look for another opportunity. And it can be, and I mean, it can be years down the line. And that's what frustrates them. You know, you said no, okay, I go off. Six months, a year, 2 years, 3 years down the line, I'm back in your office with a different angle. So how are you going to say no to that?
So where did you get this tenacity from?
My foster mother, to tell you the truth, being raised by her. So, I mean, I just, I made, you know, I worked as a nurse practitioner in Seattle. I was one of the first nurse practitioners, and I got a job even before I graduated from my nurse practitioner school. I got a job. I went on an interview where they were interviewing people who had been out in practice, and people said, "Well, you weren't qualified." I said, "That was for them to say. Why would I say that to myself? I wanted the job, I go interview. They don't want to interview me, that's their issue, not mine." And so when I got it, and I was their public health nurse for 5 years. I was their nurse practitioner for 5 years. I was told when I decided to look for my teaching job, people said to me, "You didn't graduate from a top-name school. They only hire people from a top-name school. You're not going to get a job." I'm like, "Well, we'll see." Worst thing that happened, they say no. But I'm not going to limit myself based on what other people say will happen. So I feel like that's one of the things that I think people are afraid of, the no. And if you get afraid of no, then you limit yourself. But if you think of no as not now, then it's just a temporary handicap.
Postponement. So those of you who are listening in, we will extend this show tonight on race treaty. My name is Onaji Moeed. It is truly my divine pleasure to speak to Queen Mother Randall about her life and these transition points and her consciousness and her thinking. A young woman born in the South, in so-called segregated South, who has overcome all of the barriers that, you know, a young Black woman would be faced with, you know, going to school, graduating, changing careers, moving geographically to different locations around the country. Every hurdle she confronted was one just to jump over. And she kept jumping higher and higher and higher, and has become illustrative in terms of who she's become as a person, as a professor, as a philosopher, as an educator, as an elder in our community. And it's such an honor to be in this interview with you, sharing your life and your triumphs in terms of all these different barriers that you overcame. So we will continue with the interview. I want to pause for a moment and ask you, as I've asked you a few things and you shared some things, did we leave out any other points that you really want this listening audience to know about, just
no,
from what
I
we've talked about so far?
No, that sounds good.
Okay, all right. So let me ask you this. The people who became friends, because you said you went from being like really non-political to political, having a lot to do with the time in which you were living and what was happening on campus. Have you maintained friendships with those people who were in this conversation of political consciousness and the civil rights movement? Have you maintained friendships with those persons?
Not very well connected friendships. My moving away from Texas, we went our separate ways. We have been reconnecting in the last 10 years or so. We have been reconnecting, especially since the internet. I've been reconnecting with some of the people that I was involved in things at the University of Texas with.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of, yeah, so no, I didn't maintain heavy connections until fairly recently.
Over those years, were there certain formulations, certain organizations that you found a particular affinity towards that helped you in this upward climb, not just professionally, but just in terms of a conscious Black woman thinking about your people and human rights? Were there particular organizations that seemed to support that upsurge?
I never was much of an organizational person, and so I never went out, and it may have come from, I never really belonged to organizations. I tried to support whoever was out there doing the work, but I didn't necessarily join different organizations. I have been more, I've joined the Africana Elders Council here in town and the National Black Elders Council, but up to recently, I didn't really belong to a lot of organizations. But I supported the different ones who were involved in the work. National Conference of Black Lawyers, those kinds of organizations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So even though
I'm drawing a blank right now. What is the organization that's been doing such fabulous work for so many years on reparations?
NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Yes, I haven't ever belonged to them, but I actually worked with them quite a bit for several years.
Well, what comes to mind is the quote often reference quote to Ella Baker. And she says that, you know, I didn't come here to build an organization. I came here to build a movement.
Yeah.
So well, you and Ella Baker seem to be of the same, cut from the same cloth.
And also, I have to say, yeah, I do believe sort of that, because I think, and in fact, I was talking to someone today about the danger of organizations, that if you, the danger of try is that you can spend up spending your time trying to organize as opposed to just doing. And so that what we need is a lot of small groups of people who are doing things, who come together when they need to come together, but instead of trying to, we always, you know, the white institutional model is these large organizations and with lots of people who support them. But we need circles of small groups who are doing their thing, who interact together and support each other, sort of like family and community, and not so much worry about what big organization. To be honest, I had to make a choice as a single mother. I had two children. They were 6 years apart. And once I made the decision to develop a professional career, I had to make the decision. I do not believe, and I think it's a falsehood to believe that you can do everything.
Mm-hmm.
No one can do everything. And that you can have a family, you can have a career, you can raise children, and you can be involved in your community at a high level, like getting involved in organizations. It seemed to me that to the extent that you try to do all of those without consciously making a choice, you might slack up on the ones that are the most important to you. And that we only have so much energy and so much energy to give. Forget energy and time. We only have so much we can give. And that if you are out there trying to balance everything, it is not I did not think it was a problem to make a choice. So my first priority was, I got to have a job because my kids got to eat. I can't slack up on my profession because my kids got to eat. I can't slack up on my kids because they have a limited time on this earth with me, and they will be out of my house before I know it. And if I don't do what they need when they need it, then they won't get. And so it meant that between those two choices, I made the choice not to get involved in organizational things because I didn't have time for that.
Okay.
It's only been in the last 10 years. 15 years since my kids got grown, since my kids have gotten grown and left home, that I have actually gotten and started getting involved in different kinds of organizational entities. So I say that because that's the choice I made. People make different choices, but I really would like to say there's no shame in taking care of your career and your family first.
And certainly, you know, added to that is being, you know, were you a single mom?
I never was married, yes. And okay. I never lived with anyone.
So
everything that I've done has been as a single mother.
Yeah. So it's not just taking care of your family and your career, but being a single mother that has to negotiate all those different environments, you know, by yourself, is without a mother, right? I would imagine limited connection with your biological families.
That's correct.
You are a maverick, and certainly one who has charted new waters. And I'm hoping that you would consider writing an autobiography. I'm really hoping that you would do that.
My children have been trying to encourage me to do it, and I actually am really thinking I'm going to do it. It keeps coming up. people keep raising it. And I also believe I've come to a couple of, I decided that those of us that grew up during the Jim Crow era need to write a record. If for no other reason that there's our voice, it's told in our own voice.
Well, I would encourage that, but I'd also say maybe the first step is to do an audio record with the Library of Congress. There was this storytelling campaign that went on a few years back. I'm sure it's still there, where you actually make a recording and it's stored in Congress. So that could be the first step towards the books. I wouldn't want the book to be not done.
Well, I actually already have that. History Makers did an interview with me about 4 or 5 years ago, and their tapes are on audio. You've heard of History Makers?
No, I haven't.
History Makers is a really great organization. It's a black organization that goes around the country interviewing black people and getting their stories down on tape.
And how do you access it?
It's on the, they're on the internet, but they also have gotten permission to store them in the Library of Congress.
Fabulous.
And they've done hundreds of them. Hundreds. Some some people who are just working like me. But I think that's exactly right. I think that we do need to capture the history of people. I just really feel like we missed the generation of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So my generation, we don't need to lose that generation, the 70 to 90-year-olds.
I am just so honored to be in this conversation with you, and look to have many more, in fact. So, this is really refreshing for so many reasons. Now I think I want to ask you, what's next for us as a people? What's next?
Well, as black people in a country that is moving towards a de facto apartheid, or has already moved into a de facto apartheid and getting worse. The whole privatization movement is about making sure that people with money don't have to assure that people who have less money, that they have to pay for anything. They don't want to pay for housing, food, transportation. They don't want to pay for education. So the privatization, they don't want to pay for the post office. So what's next is we're going to be a small minority. We're already a small minority. Black people are 12%. It's not a lot. And I think we tend to forget that 12% is not a large percentage of the population. I don't know. I worry about what happens to us, especially Dayas, descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States. I think that there's no way to know where we are and what's happening with us and where we go from here. But I do think that we have to identify ourselves as a people's worth international. We have to quit. We have to identify ourselves as a people's like Native Americans. At least Dayas do.
Tell us about that. I don't know if the listener on this knows too much about that wording, that phraseology. Is that an organization? Is that a
No, I'm not talking about an organization. I'm talking about under international law, indigenous peoples have rights that are related to them being indigenous, and that those rights are well respected to the extent countries respect them, but those are rights that are independent from treaty rights related to discrimination, right? And it's been occurring to me that Dayists, descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States, are indigenous peoples, not Native Americans. I don't want to go down that road. I am not arguing that African Americans, Dayists, are Native Americans and need to be recognized that way. I'm saying that Dayists exist no one there but in the United States. That we don't come from Nigeria. We don't come from Ghana. We don't have a country from which we form. That the United States stole, the transatlantic slave trade stole millions of people off the continent of Africa, people who were unrelated to each other, sold them into slavery on this country, and then forced them into an identity. But that's like taking flour, milk, eggs, baking powder, and mixing it. It's not flour anymore. It's not eggs anymore. It's a cake. You don't think of... So what has happened to us is we were forced into this relationship on this continent, which makes us indigenous to this continent, and that we need to claim that. We need to be saying to the UN, except for Native Americans, except for Indians, we can't look to a specific country that our ancestors came from. And it's because of what this country did. So that's what I mean by that we need to, if we claim that indigenous status and we put that with reparations, it may be possible to get some land for the community.
Whew, okay. All right. We're talking about land. Had you had any connection or reading with the principles or the positions that was proposed by the Republic of New Africa, Imari, ancestor Imari Obadeli?
No.
Okay. All right. So I know that you've been a consultant for ICRAM, the International Human Rights Association for American Minorities.
Correct, and they are advocating a plebiscite, and they advocate that kind of yes.
So this is part one. We're going to have a part two. This is part one where we have gone back into history and asked our very willing guest to share with us who she is, how she become who she's become, and how. Going through the different stages of our life, using the very beginning of the interview as topical sentences in the different paragraphs of our life. And she's taken us from Texas to Oregon to Alaska and to law school and teaching in Ohio, and as a professor emeritus, what she's doing now, what she's about to do, and we've just gotten into the human rights aspect of her work and what she's been doing. She and I met in Durban, South Africa in 2001, so part two will go further into depth about her thinking, what we should be focusing on, what should we be doing. I want to spend time in terms of those small circles because I've come up with the same conclusion. I call them social health circles, and I have a whole strategy of how that might work. So certainly I want to share that with her and have us both talk on that in part two. So, Queen Mother Vanella Randall, thank you so much for sharing with us your life and your triumphs and obstacles and your philosophy of life. It's been such an education, and this is going to, I think, help a lot of people in many different kinds of ways, because you overcome all the odds that you can. I mean, how can you be pregnant in school and still graduate and go on to become a lawyer and all the other things you've become? Well, you've showed us how, you know, by holding on to one's tenacity and saying no is not no. No is just means not now. They just said it a different kind of a way. So you've given us, to some extent, your philosophy of life, shared with us your thinkings, your concerns, your strategy for life, and we are so grateful for your magnanimity in terms of sharing this with us. Thank you so much. Any closing remarks you want to say for part one?
Well, no, I really appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, there's one thing we do like is telling our stories, and the opportunity to tell my story has been a pleasure. And I really appreciate the work you do with the Black Radio Network and with human rights, and I look forward to working with you all on the Dais issues, the descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States.
Okay, well, that will certainly be a key topic in part two, and you have been invited to be a co-host of Race Treaty, and when it's, you know, convenient for you to do so and how you would want to do so, that is an open invitation, so we consider you part of the Race Treaty Collective anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and we'll be talking to each other soon for part two. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you've been listening to Race Treaty with Onaji Mawid, the co-host, interviewing Queen Mother Vanella Randall. Thank you so very much, and good night.